So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight. Oh.
Listen to Review Man.
I didn't want to appear like I was selling out to make a profit off what happened. I'd known Sean had become a very strong Christian value guy, and I just sort of knew the old Sean. I thought, well, I hope I'll go ahead and I'm going to take the step out and reach out and sort of offer my hand to Sean. And I kind of figured, I said, well, shake hands and we'll probably be, you know, we'll go through the motions and be friends. But I said, in a few weeks, Sean will start having that attitude again, and we'll have these problems between us. And there's a part of me going, for that reason, it wouldn't be worth it. But in saying that, finally, when I did, I was flying actually on a flight to Dayton for that Monday Night Raw for my return. And Sean, I think he called me and left me a nice message on my phone, which I was in the air when I got. And when I got off the plane, I listened to it. And then I just texted him, and it was like, to me, it was like that was the end of it. Like, we really did make peace, and it was like he was really respectful and friendly to me, and we kind of picked up just like we always did. I've always felt that Sean's sincerity was genuine, and that he really, I felt like I lifted a big rock off Sean and set him free.
Welcome to Review Away. It's John Pollock, joined by Wei Ting and Mr. Ting. We are joined in studio by a legend.
Yes, absolutely. A legend of many years in this industry. What else can we say?
Well, we needed somebody, someone on the inside, someone involved in all of this as we chat about the Greatest Rivalries DVD, Jimmy Corderas returning to Review Away.
Well, thanks for having me, guys, but that was better sucking up than Miz and R-Truth with John Laurinaitis there. What the heck's going on?
Yeah, but
do I have to make my voice a little raspy now?
No, that means we have to go on for another 3 minutes and have a horrendous backstage segment as they did on Sunday.
I'm kidding. Thanks, guys. I really appreciate this.
Vengeance is long forgotten by this point, but Greatest Rivalries. And Jimmy, you had a chance to see this over the past week, and we're basically just going to review the DVD and chat about it, because I think you can offer a lot of insight that maybe didn't make its way into the DVD, and just stuff that was going on at the time from the talent's perspective with these two very interesting personalities at a very pivotal point. I think everyone kind of looks at that 96-97 period as one of the most interesting for the WWF at the time, when they were behind WCW, but you had so much momentum going at that time that I think it's a period in time that a lot of people look back to and like to analyze for 2 hours on a DVD such as this one.
Yeah, it was really an interesting time. It was different, hopefully I could offer a little bit here from an outsider's perspective. I mean, watching the DVD and hearing certain things, you know, it sort of clicks certain memories, stuff you forget about, and you start thinking back and going, really, I didn't think of it that way. That's interesting that, you know, especially with Brett, because Brett's memory was unbelievable.
That's where I wanted to start, was Brett hard on this DVD. I mean, he's always someone that, I mean, he's built up such a credibility with himself where, I mean, throughout his career took meticulous notes and has just been very fact-based in everything he has talked about, written in his book, and his memory in this DVD is just, it's incredible. Where he, right down to conversations, what was said and what city it took place in. What did you think about Brett in this DVD, Brett?
Wow. Well, Brett was Brett. I mean, you and I, John, we've had pretty much a firsthand account of it ourselves, producing that documentary we did for the Fight Network. So he came across like he did exactly in that, and I have no doubt that the editors had a lot of content they had to chop down. In fact, you could even tell Jim Ross at some point in this DVD was trying to have to rush everything because they realized they were so short on time. But by the time that they reached like an hour 40 into it, they were only up till the end of Survivor Series, and they really had 13 more years to cover in the last 20 minutes. So,
which was kind of when we did our documentary and we went out to Calgary to interview Brett. I think I did close to a 4-hour interview with him.
Ran out of tapes and we panicked.
Well, suddenly our cameraman who we had hired out there told me we're down to 2 more tapes. And I just panicked because I was at 1992 in questions. Brett had talked for about 3 hours from like 70 breaking in to 1992. And I was like, how the fuck am I going to cover 18 years in 2 tapes?
You know what? I really think that this is a Hart family trait. I think it's part of their DNA. I mean, if you've run into... They're storytellers. You've run into several of the Harts, both of you. I mean, like, you run into Bruce, and if you get caught by Bruce, it's a minimum 45 minutes.
Bruce, I always thought, was the one who could go the longest, but then I met Smith. And Smith could literally... Like, I once spoke to him for 45 minutes, and I said 2 things. He just loves to talk. And, I mean, it's evident throughout any of the Hart family I've met. They're just they love to talk, and they are very open.
Now, well, just to get off topic real quick about Smith, the first time I really, really got to meet him was at a Dragon's Gate USA show here in Toronto, out of Mississauga. And he sat there beside me for most of the card, analyzing every match, telling me what was wrong with every match and how he would have booked it and how it... I mean, you know, no problem, but let me sit back and enjoy the match. You know what I mean? He just went on and on. Then he said, then he asked me if there was how to get a booking gig at WWE and stuff like that, and I was, wow, all right.
It's the Hart family. They're one of the most unique families I think you'll ever come across. And I think, especially for Canadian wrestling fans, there's just something about the Hart family that is just so fascinating. It's, I don't know. I don't know what would be a comparison point from an American perspective, but it's just...
Not only the trait, but their style and their delivery as well. It's very constant throughout most of the brothers. I mean, maybe Keith not as much, but definitely amongst all the others that we've spoken to, just a very soft, gravelly voice with the slow delivery. And that was certainly evident in this.
And they all do a perfect Stu Hart imitation, too.
Yeah. Stu Hart. Did you catch Hulk Hogan's Stu Hart recently? He did an interview with Pete Rosenberg.
Yes.
Didn't do too bad a Stu. I give it like a 6 on the scale.
Yeah, I think Stu is one of the most imitated people out there in the business.
I think he would have to be. Jim Ross was the one who kind of quarterbacked this whole thing as the one conducting the interview. And I thought Jim Ross, I couldn't imagine anyone else in that company outside of a Vince McMahon doing this. And I don't think Vince would have done it half as effectively. I mean, for you know, marketing-wise, I mean, getting Vince on there would have added something. But I thought Jim Ross was just excellent in his role in this entire DVD.
Yeah, and I think because he was so instrumental and so much involved in the situation and what was going on back, especially during the events leading up to Montreal. I think, like you said, perfect choice to MC this thing.
Could you imagine if Todd Grisham did this sit down interview?
Or Cole?
Oh,
Matt Stryker?
Jim Ross himself is a historian, so you can tell he has a lot of respect for knowledge of all these years of the business. So,
and he was there. He was there.
Exactly.
So, I mean, that adds so much more. I mean, I think at that time, at 97, I'm pretty sure he was heading up talent relations at that point. He had succeeded, I think, J.J. Dillon, right? And Dillon left, I think, around 96 or so, something like that. So anyway, it starts off where they talk about the tag scene, where both got their break with the Hart Foundation and the Rockers, and they got into this really interesting discussion about size and how Sean noted it was never an issue in any of the territories he had gone to. Size, him being small, was actually a great thing, as being a babyface where he could sell for the heel. But in the WWF, it was a very different mentality, and you could tell this was something that really ate away specifically at Sean, who was always, he had all the talent in the world, but his size at that point in time was definitely going to hold him back.
Yeah, well, the perception back then with and honestly, I shouldn't say perception, it pretty much was that the WWF at the time was the land of the giants. Everybody there that was a huge star, starting from Hulk Hogan on down, was a big you know, muscled up, jacked up guy, you know, with a few exceptions like a King Kong Bundy or a Kamala or somebody like that, but still big guys. So, you know, I could sense his frustration, and I understand it too. And there were a lot of guys on the roster back then who thought that talent should supersede look, and, you know, they were frustrated.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to kind of get to the beginning of this chapter, where Jim Ross starts asking Brett and Sean about their first impressions of one another. In particular, Brett mentions that when the Rockers came in, they already had sort of a reputation for people who, you know, maybe partied a lot and weren't the easiest to get along with. If you were there, Jimmy, what were the reputations of both Brett and Sean like at the time?
Well, the Rockers definitely did come in with a reputation of being somewhat partiers, and from my experience, maybe a little bit well-deserved reputation. I mean, there were young guys who were kind of living the rock star lifestyle, and they were, you know, enjoying their time. I mean, it was a different era back then. It was completely different from what you see from the guys today. You know, guys back then, like I said, lived the rock star lifestyle. It was party hard and work hard, And Brett wasn't that guy. Brett was completely different. Brett was the kind of guy, you know, he would go out and maybe have a drink or two with the boys, but he wasn't the party hard kind of guy, and was really kept to himself and was somewhat reserved. But you knew they had a respect for one another, but the lifestyles were completely different.
Was there ever kind of did anyone ever talk about, you know, these two could be at some day the future of our company? Was that ever something evident, or were these were two guys low on the card in the tag division, and that's kind of how they were perceived? Was it ever something that, you know, where could this guy be in 5-7 years?
I don't think that anybody perceived them being Sean or Brett being mega stars at the time. I think they were perceived as more as, these guys are good hands, these guys will produce good matches, they'll be the workhorses, but they'll be kind of middle of the card guys, and we'll leave the main event spots to the guys like the Hogans and the Warriors and those guys.
And this was when the tag division, I thought, was at its height within the company, where you did get your workhorses, the Bulldogs, the Killer Bees, the Rougeos. I mean, there was such a depth of tag team talent at the time, and I think that's a period people automatically go back to when comparing the current tag scene, or how it's been for the majority of the past 5 to 8 years, and you look back at all the depth and how you were able to create talent who maybe they weren't ready to be singles stars at the time, but by being in a tag team, you could hide little weaknesses, and at one point, you could hopefully take one or both guys and graduate to being singles stars.
Yeah, and you look back to like certain Survivor Series matches where they had the tag team Survivor matches, and there'd be 5 legitimate tag teams on each side. That's 10, you know, full-time legitimate tag teams. I mean, what an era that was.
It was also interesting to look at the Saturday night's main event match, where this match completely fell apart. And Jimmy, what were your thoughts going back to this when it took place here, with the ring just collapsing, falling apart, and Brett calling this one of the worst matches he had ever been a part of?
Yeah, I know, and they did reference the referee in this one. He said they looked like a deer in the headlights, not knowing what to do. And
they kind of threw him under the bus.
They did kind of throw him under the bus, but at the same time, this was in a different era. I mean, it's not like today where the referees are mic'd and they have their IFBs and they can get instruction from the back of somebody saying, hey, here's what we're going to do. But at the same time, you know, you got to think on the spot, and you can't put it all on the referee. These guys got to think, too, that, okay, this is a taped show. It's not live. So, you know, there's usually a spare rope under the ring. What would it take? 5 minutes to rip that one off and put another one back on, and then you can continue the match?
Yeah.
That was my take on it. I'm thinking, you know, I'm obviously thinking from a ring crew referee perspective. Okay, it's a tape match. Stop tape. Let's go. Fix this up. Start over.
Yeah, I was first of all, I thought it was excellent the way they were able to tell this story and have all the footage. I mean, it's something that you take for granted watching a WWE DVD, but I think, Wei, you know, you and I can speak to this.
Absolutely.
Just, man, what a luxury when you can just have all this footage at your disposal to tell these stories. And I kept thinking here, as Brett and Sean were kind of railing on this ref, is like, what was he going to do? This one guy was going to, what, fix the entire ring here? It's like, this was the perfect example of a match needing to just stop and let's get our bearings and let's fix this problem.
But who would be in charge of that decision? I mean, if was Vince backstage? Were there people, the directors controlling this? I mean, what was stopping somebody from back there coming out and saying let's redo this?
I really don't know. I mean, like, obviously Vince is the man in charge, and I don't believe it was it Kevin Dunn back then. I don't remember had he taken over that spot yet. But you know, it should have been automatic. I mean, especially, like I said, like in a tape situation, that should have been an automatic. That shouldn't, you know. And one of the things, and this is again off topic, one of the criticisms about the WWE rings that I have is because they use real rope, there is going to always be the possibility of this happening. When you use the
cables,
there is less of a chance of that happening. So you're always running the risk of something like that happening when you use real rope.
Did the rope actually break, or was it the connection?
No, it was the top rope. I mean, you could see that the other ropes, the middle and the bottom, were still intact.
Right.
But the top
rope just split.
Yeah, and but didn't break completely. It kind of like, you know, because being real rope, there's like three strands and they're interwoven. Mm. It looked like two strands broke and one of them stayed intact, which means.
I know a lot of like the cruiserweights and stuff, they always just would prefer the cables as well when it came to doing their spots using the top rope. I mean, the WCW, that was what they used, were cables, and it just seemed to be a lot more sturdier for guys that were using those top ropes, whereas in the WWF, especially at that time period, that really wasn't a consideration. But you think cables overall, is that something you're more a proponent of?
Only because I think they're safer and less risk of them breaking.
Mr. Ting, what let's go to some of your notes as well, what you want to chat about.
Well, they go on talking about their individual singles careers as they both split from the tag teams, and they really showcase how Brett's singles career started off by his feud with Kurt Hennig and winning the IC title. He says also that at the time, he wasn't concerned about his wrestling. He always thought his wrestling was his strongest point. It was the promos that really held him back. So this feud with Hennig and the fact that Hennig really helped champion Brett as somebody who could carry the title really helped him get through that. He felt like he was a banner. He was like carrying a banner for a lot of the smaller guys. And this is what really bonded Sean and Brett together at that time. The two of them really saw themselves as the new generation, calling, you know, all the Hogans and the Warriors and the Andres, the dinosaurs of the past, and they ran this dinosaur metaphor into the ground. Them and JR. JR's like, their species was larger.
But it was funny, though, is that they used that dinosaur metaphor, and then later on in the DVD, it was kind of, that was kind of the label he put on Brett when Sean was trying to make himself a more edgier character and feeling that Brett was the dinosaur here, which was it was interesting.
Mm-hmm. For you, Jimmy, working there, did you notice a certain point when this shift began to happen? Like, did it actually click for you that, hey, we're seeing a change here?
You know what? I didn't notice it overtly like that. It was a gradual thing, and it didn't really pop into my head. Because for me, looking at Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels at the time, Bret at that time was a legit 230, 235. Mm-hmm. So to me, he wasn't, you know, to me, he's not a small guy.
Yeah.
But in the land of the giants, he's considered a small guy. And Shawn was probably 220, 225 at the time, you know.
Heavyweights in the UFC.
Yeah, they still wouldn't qualify as cruiserweights today. I mean, so to me, they weren't – I didn't consider them small guys. I thought they were – by wrestling standards, I thought they were normal size.
I thought it was interesting because the person that Brett ended up winning the title from was Ric Flair. And how big is Flair?
Flair wasn't much bigger. I mean, no. 240 maybe? I might be being generous there. Maybe even a bit smaller than that. I mean, Flair was never a big guy to begin with. I mean, even Kurt Hennig. I mean, you didn't look at him and think, you know, giant WWF main eventer.
But Hennig was never the champion, never had that top spot.
Yeah, but they kind of talked about in this where, you know, when Hart won the IC title, it was a big changing of the guard where, I don't know if that was necessarily it, but and Sean brought up, it was when he beat Flair. Mm-hmm. That's when everyone kind of clicked that we're going in a much different direction. And Flair was much, very much a throwback to the 80s at that point, and I think Brett was kind of their homegrown guy that they were putting into that spot. Imagine that, TNA, a promotion using your own homegrown talent as your flagship.
I was really surprised that they got into the whole size issue as much as they did in this DVD. I mean, considering this really still is a WWE-produced DVD, the fact that they would basically criticize the company's direction for choosing big
men. They were careful,
men.
Though, too. Like, yeah, I mean, Brett goes on the size in his book and about kind of like this inadvertent pressure to get on steroids. It's like, I have no doubt that talent has never been told get on steroids, but when you see guys getting pushed here, how do you not think that if you're sitting in the locker room and you're 230 pounds feeling like you're a Shawn Michaels who's super talented but I'm not big enough? I mean, there's obviously there's that non-spoken, you know, idea thrown out there that,
well,
you know.
Yeah, I guess it's the pressure. You want to be that top guy. It's the reason why everybody, you know, gets into the business. You don't get into wrestling to be the guy in the opening match for the rest of your career. You want to be a top guy and make top money. And a lot of guys figured maybe that's the way for me to do it.
And that pressure, Sean says here, is really got to him in his youth. And he cites it as part of the reason why he was so antagonistic at this time. I mean, he makes a great analogy saying that, you know, if you're a star on a football team and you're scoring all these points for the team, who cares what size you are, right? And it's true. I mean, if you can believably perform in the ring in a pro wrestling match, I mean, it shouldn't matter how big you are.
Yeah, I agree.
And that was an interesting kind of a comparison point, especially as the mid-90s wore on and you saw the WCW product versus the WWF product, and it always seemed to be that WCW had this strong undercard and their main eventers just kind of got by with name value from the past, whereas the WWF, that was where your main events really delivered with your Bretts, your Shawns, and that whole top end where the main events were really what distinguished them. And that was always an interesting debate, was like, well, where do you want your quality matches to be? Should it be on the undercard, or should it be what you're selling your show on? And it was an interesting comparison between both companies.
It's kind of like TNA right now, actually, when you think about it, with the Hogan and Sting angle on the very top, and then you have the workhorses with the world title. So, and it's Hogan.
But and not it's TNA, so... Yes. They're not exactly knocking anybody dead at this point. In terms of the ascension of Shawn Michaels, Jimmy, I mean, Shawn readily admits at this point, like, he was a very, very difficult person to deal with. But did you ever get to see any of this? I mean, was this something that it was people have difficulties working with the guy, or was it something that, you know, from an official's point of view, I mean, you were dealing with this guy in the ring where he was arguably one of the best of his generation?
On a personal standpoint, I didn't experience any of that Shawn Michaels, you know, attitude and stuff like that. He was always, you know, professional with me and very, and somewhat respectful, I think, mostly because I didn't pose a threat to his position. You know what I mean? I was just a guy that worked there, you know what I mean? Whereas guys like Brett, maybe he felt was a threat to his spot, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And the one thing that I noticed, and this could be just me, but I thought that when Shawn was with the so-called clique, he was kind of different. He was a little more antagonistic. Whereas when he was by himself, he was very, very much a little drawn back. You know, he didn't have that swagger that he did when he was around the other guys.
Mm. Yeah, it was also interesting after Hall and Nash left, it seemed that, you know, would Shawn be kind of in the same position when he didn't have, you know, Nash and Hall and this kind of power group together, but instead it seemed to just escalate Michaels feeling that he understood how valuable he was to this company and having this threat of I could go to the competition anytime I wanted, when the company was really in bad straits at that point in 97 before everything exploded a year later.
Well, he still had Hunter at the time, but more so than that, he was... We have a coffee spill in the Reveal Way Studios, courtesy of one John Pollock.
Oops.
Okay, well, Jimmy and I will go on. But not only did Sean, you know, he didn't have Hall and Nash, but he had the power in the company. He was now one of the two top stars in the company, so he had the support of Vince as that next big guy.
Yeah, and it was funny. It was a weird feeling in the locker room because, you know, Sean definitely had the reputation of being at times difficult to get along with. So a lot of the guys in the back couldn't understand why he had so much stroke and how, why is Vince listening to this guy? You know what I mean? The guy is just, you know, he's out of control at times.
As far as you could tell, was this of any concern to Vince? You know, Sean's reputation at the time.
Not that I was aware of. I don't know. Obviously, I had very limited access to Vince, especially at that time. It was just very much, "Hey, boss, how you doing?"
I've got this problem with Sean. Motherfucker.
Yeah. What should I do? I don't know.
I'd also like to know. Let's talk about Brett and basically his ascension to becoming one of the leaders of that locker room. Did you notice any change with Brett and his character from like the late 80s to the mid 90s?
Not really. I mean, Brett has always been Brett. He when he was with Jim, he was the same guy. And then when he became, the only difference really was, actually, there wasn't really much any difference. I mean, other than the fact that, like you said, he became more of a locker room leader and guys would come to him with questions and stuff. And when they had concerns, they would ask Brett his opinion and that sort of stuff. But other than that, really, he hadn't changed.
And that came across a lot in this DVD, that kind of Brett was like kind of one of the boys, whereas Sean, when push came to shove, was very much out for himself at that time period. And at that point, I was curious, was Sean still... like, what was the back room or the backstage kind of setup? Like, did Sean ever at one point get his own locker room? Was he ever, like, not part of the boys in that respect? Or was everyone always typically together? Or how did that work?
Well, it varied from TV to TV. It all depended on the buildings. I mean, like, certain arenas offer you, you know, several locker room choices. And, you know, guys would pair off. Everybody was kind of, you know, we referred to them as the clique. Everybody was kind of cliquish. You know, these guys would group together in one locker room and these guys would group together in another. So it all depended on what the facilities allowed. And many times there weren't that many locker rooms, so everybody was pretty much together. And it wasn't this we're getting our own locker room kind of thing. That was kind of back
overblown.
Yeah, it was overblown. I mean, back in the Hogan days, Hogan would get pretty much his own room. I remember specifically at Maple Leaf Gardens, the old Maple Leaf Gardens, he would get the director's room in the back there by the locker rooms. And, you know, guys like Beefcake, of course, and a few others would change in there with him. But, you know, that didn't really happen that I saw anyways.
They got to we'll kind of talk about Montreal here. I don't know what new we can add to Montreal, but they spent 40 minutes on it on this 2-hour DVD, which they did make a big point to say, you know, that this was not Montreal does not define these two men's careers. But at the same time was a huge drawing point for this DVD, and obviously they had to discuss it in depth. I don't know if any new details really came out of this, but it was just interesting to see both perspectives here at the time, and Sean willingly taking the blame for this, despite, you know, Vince telling him that, you know, I'll take the heat for this, but Sean knowing at the time that it doesn't matter, you're the boss, no one's going to have any personal grudges against you. It's I'm the one who's doing this, and I'm the one who's going to have to assume the guilt here.
The story really, like, they pretty much begin, the tension between Brett and Sean really begins as Sean was being groomed for that top spot to take over as the top babyface. And it really, like, even before Survivor Series, it really starts near WrestleMania 11, doesn't it? When Sean was supposed to fight Diesel, and that didn't really turn out as great as they had hoped. In fact, Sean was supposed to work as the heel, but instead somehow turned into the babyface by the end of that match. And Brett saw now Sean as pretty much in direct competition with him for that spot.
True, true. And there were little things. I mean, like, they even mentioned in the DVD themselves that they were kind of working the boys in the back.
Yeah.
They wanted the boys in the back to believe that there was this tension between them. Here's the Shawn Michaels, the rock star party atmosphere guy, versus the down to earth, you know, old school, so to speak, wrestler. And they kind of, you know, that, it, you know, the rumor started that these guys were kind of like not getting along. So they kind of perpetuated the rumor and said, you know, let's feed off this and almost work the boys in the back. You know?
Yeah, they went into the WrestleMania 12 match in Anaheim, where after the match, Sean, I guess through Earl, had told Brett, basically telling him, get out of the ring for my post-match stuff. And Brett kind of just blew that off as Sean just working, and that they were going to be building to a rematch. And then Brett stormed off in the back. And then about a week later, because that's when Brett was taking his time off and wasn't on the road, and Owen was calling him, telling them everyone thought that he had legit heat with Sean at the time. And Brett was just ecstatic at this of, you know, working the boys, which is always, you're really getting into a different territory, I think, whenever you try to work the locker room, because it typically never works out too well.
No, it's this weird thing in the wrestling business. Once you start trying to work the boys in the back, and then you start blurring storyline with reality, unfortunately, it's going to become reality.
Yeah, it's something very unique to wrestling in that it's a industry amongst the workers that it's so built on trust, and it's when you try to work them, it's just this kind of powder keg that's going to explode at some point where, you know, you're trying to work a guy that you're asking, well, take care of me in the ring. It's just this weird dynamic in wrestling.
It got to the point where even Sean and Brett couldn't tell what was a work and what wasn't. I mean, it's so funny how even the producers of this thing don't know if it's real or fake.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it all built up to that incident in Hartford where they had their little... They had their little mix-up backstage in the locker room, which was funny because they didn't mention this in the DVD, which I thought was interesting, was after their little dust-up in the locker room, that night, Monday Nitro, WCW we were in Hartford, and Nitro was in Boston, which is, 90 miles away?
Yeah.
And after the dust-up, Sean, like, blew a gasket and was threatening that he was going to quit and go over driving down to Boston right now, and that was it. And everybody was like, what the heck is going on? What the hell happened? You know what I mean? And you know, everybody, is he going to go? No, he's not going to go. Yeah, he's saying he's going, you know? So
I'd never heard that story.
Now, I don't know if this was, again, them working the locker room, figuring, Sean thinking, okay, we had our little dust up. Here's me going to throw a little more fuel on the fire. So, you know. Whether he was being honest or just working everybody again, who knows?
They talk about Sean's WrestleMania 13 injury from his match having to pull out with Sid. Brett still maintains that he doesn't believe that Sean was legitimately injured, but Sean says it was a very real injury and basically, you know, defends how the doctors told him he couldn't wrestle, and his tears and that promo with Vince, everything was very real to him. He thought it might have been the end of his career. What were your thoughts at that time?
I didn't know what to think of it. I mean, I was looking at other people, and without mentioning names, there were a lot of people in the back who didn't buy the story.
Yeah.
I mean, they just thought that was just Sean refusing to do the honors, you know, or just Sean being Sean and taking his ball and going home kind of thing. I didn't have an opinion one way or another. I mean, again, it was one of those situations where, you know, that's one let the boys handle that. And that wasn't really something that I should get involved. I tried to stay out of that crap, you know?
Yeah. And so Sean missed the WrestleMania that year, and that's kind of something Brett brought up, the fact that here we were behind WCW at the time. This is our biggest show of the year, and here one of our top talents was basically faking this knee injury and not working our biggest show. And that was the original plan for WrestleMania that year. It was Michaels and Hart, and in a weird way they had to go to plan B, and just they put Brett with Austin, and here was that was a match that really, you know, Austin was gaining steam at that point, and that match was huge.
But Brett was pissed because all the buildup from the previous year of WrestleMania was towards Brett versus Shawn, was towards his payoff, and for Brett not to get that payoff, it just felt like a lot of waste of time simply because this guy didn't want to play, basically.
And that was one of the best exchanges between the two, where Brett's basically like just talking, Yeah, the match with Austin, it was good, but there was no interest going in, and it was just so it wasn't the match people wanted. So if I couldn't work with Sean, and then Sean cuts him off, yeah. So you had the best match in like WrestleMania history as your substitute. Yeah. It's like shut up.
You know, and that's the funny thing that I found from that exchange too, that you know that was really the launching point for the Stone Cold era. I mean, they caught lightning in a bottle that night, I think, and. You know, it started to elevate the company in their battle with WCW, and this is my perspective, isn't the whole idea that we're all working towards the same goal, you know, as a company trying to be the number one guys, so shouldn't you be a little more ecstatic that this worked out this way, even though you wanted the match with Sean? It felt, you know, with all due respect to Brett, it felt a little selfish to present it that way, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's something that ended up, I mean, theoretically, you had created this new heel that was, you know, eventually going to become your top babyface, and if all things worked out, you still have the Michaels match, and you've created a number of programs on top at the time, and that was that period in 97 that was so interesting, because yes, Raw was not beating Nitro that year, but you watched that show and it was just building, it seemed. They went into the Team Canada feud and then all the stuff in the fall leading up to the Survivor Series. I mean, it was like must-see television every week, and a large part of that was Brett and Shawn, where you had this deal where, for people that knew what was going on at the time, these two guys really didn't like each other, cutting promos on each other each week, and it was something that you were really invested in because it was very legitimate, this feud between the two.
Yeah, and it filtered backstage. I mean, everybody in the back bought into it too, and it was, for them, it was must-see television at the monitor in the back. Everybody wanted to see what these guys were going to say about each other and do next.
I find it's, again, I just, pro wrestling always amazes me, just the very model of what pro wrestling is today, that you could have two people that don't like each other air out their grievances on not live TV for the public to see with basically very little filter at this time. And in fact, it's encouraged by the employer.
Yeah.
That sounds dangerous to me.
It is. It's a volatile situation. I mean, it's a powder keg, you know, to steal a cliche, a powder keg ready to explode. But at the time, they were, you know, in a situation where they were willing to try anything to beat WCW in the ratings, and they figured the edgier attitude era that was beginning was the way to go, and they figured what better way than to let these guys have the mic and go.
I was surprised that they included the Sunny Days comment in the DVD. I can see that the Brett, you know, addressed it in the book, but just on a WWE DVD, I was very surprised they threw that line in to talk about it, and how awkward this must have been during this interview here with these three guys and talking about this promo. And it just shows you of just what these promos were like at the time, and just how Sean was throwing stuff at Brett and vice versa. I mean, Brett was throwing stuff at Sean as well.
Was there any concern backstage from anybody, or was it just mostly everybody kind of sitting back and enjoying, ooh, these words?
I think it was a little bit of both. I mean, like, obviously, you know, every time a comment like that would surface, there'd be a huge pop, and you'd get the, oh, did he really say that on television? Wow, I wonder what Brett's going to do when he gets to the back. And it was, again, it almost felt like there was this feeling almost in the back of everybody's mind as real as this appears, they've got to be working everybody. Mm-hmm. You know, there's still, you know, it's that wrestler's mentality. As much as you think it's real, it's still got to be a work.
It was really weird because probably very few people will remember this promo, but me and Way reviewed it a couple months back. It was the 1997 Slammy Awards, and Triple H, in his Greenwich Snob character at the time, came up and did this promo, like, pretty much out of character, basically saying that Sean had slept with Sonny, and I think even called Sonny like someone sloppy seconds or something like that. And it was like, how did this air? Like, it had nothing to do with any storyline. It was involving Shawn Michaels, who was a babyface at the time, and it was just it was pretty much who put anything on. It was just such a weird promo that aired at the time, and that was, I think, before this comment on television.
Yeah, and the bad thing about it was Chris Candido sitting there and listening to that whole thing. It was horrible.
just a very uncomfortable situation.
Brett goes on to say very candidly that he had to go home and be questioned by Stu about this comment about what's going on with Sonny, and he realized that his kids were watching at the time too. So it really drives home just how much these words got to these two.
And quickly, just talking about the Survivor Series, Jimmy, I just wanted to get kind of your sense of what was going on that day, that night. I mean, was it pretty much a foregone conclusion that that night Brett would be finishing up? Or what was kind of the impression, maybe the day of the show, if anything? Was it anything out of the ordinary?
Well, we had heard stuff about them not being sure what to do with the finish of the match. And it didn't seem anything, you know, urgent or out of the ordinary. It was pretty much a, you know, okay, these guys are going to figure something out. And Brett was not due to finish up that night, from what I understand. I thought he was going to still work a Raw.
Yeah.
Like the next night.
His contract didn't actually end till, I think Bischoff had allowed him, he could work even the December pay-per-view. So,
right. So, yeah, exactly. Then now that you brought it up, I'm pretty sure that was the deal. But, you know, he was scheduled to be in Ottawa the next night.
Mm-hmm.
And so forth. So we were told, you know, Pat Patterson, here's what's going to happen. They're going to have their match. There's going to be a big schmoz at the end. You guys run down to go break it up. And excuse me. And that, you know, we'll go off the air. It's a double DQ kind of thing. And we said, okay. So during the match, we're all the referees were up at Gorilla. I mean, like during the match, we did that thing where we ran out to break stuff up. But we're all at Gorilla and we're waiting for the match. And they went into the sharpshooter spot. And all of a sudden, Earl rings the bell, and we're all standing at Gorilla looking at each other going, what the hell just happened? We were all confused. It was like utter confusion. And you can tell that there were several of the agents there also looking at each other like it was almost like a look of disbelief. Like, did they really just do what we think they did? And I didn't clue in. I didn't, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I was like, I don't get it. What happened? You know what I mean? And then it took a few minutes, and then I went, oh, jeez. And, you know, you saw Briscoe out there. You saw Hunter go out there. And Sarge was out there with Vince and the whole bit. And it was just utter confusion and chaos backstage. You could see a lot of the boys were pissed off.
Yeah.
It was just, I can't believe they did that. And then from there on, it was just walking on eggshells the rest of the night.
I had heard that Paul, because Paul Jay obviously was doing his documentary and was in the back, and I heard that he has this footage of The Undertaker like knocking on Vince's door with a bunch of the guys standing behind him where Undertaker was going to confront Vince. And I don't know if that was just, you know, some urban legend or not, but it was obviously something that had really set off the locker room, because I think they did view Brett. I think the locker room, the majority, likely were on Brett's side here, mm-hmm. as opposed to Sean at the time.
Yeah, well, the excuse given for doing it was they were worried that he was going to leave the WWE with the championship and show up on WCW Nitro with the title. And you know, you guys have talked to Brett, you've interviewed him, and you know his mindset and the way he thinks. I can't see Brett doing something like that. I would never guess Brett would be the kind of guy that would, you know, take someone else's title and take it to another company. But at the same time, it's that time-honored tradition they talk about. Wow, I almost spilled my coffee now.
Yeah.
That time-honored tradition about, you know, doing the honors and leaving the company in the right way. So it's kind of this weird thing. And the guys were torn by it, too. At first, you saw them get really, really pissed off at the boss, saying, you know, you screwed one of ours.
Yeah.
You know, and then it's sort of like 24 hours later, as people started to think about it, you know, some guys boycotted the Raw the next night. I know Mick Foley wasn't there, I remember. I think the Legion of Doom was supposed to be there, and I don't think they showed up. So there was a bit of a protest.
Yeah, yeah.
But some of the guys were like, hey, he's the boss. It's his company. He's going to do it, you know, what he thinks is right.
And Brett pretty much, I mean, he's done this in a lot of interviews, but really kind of absolves Earl Hebner here, saying he felt terrible afterwards of Earl being put in this position where, you know, Earl was likely the night before when this conversation went down with Earl and Brett that has been cited a number of times. Earl probably had no clue at this point what the plan was and was likely only clued in minutes before the match. And, I mean, Jimmy, you have to have at some point, or maybe not, like role-played. I mean, had you been in that position? I mean, I'm sure every referee at the time probably thought, like, you know, what a terrible spot to be in here. If, you know, this is your job and this is what your boss is telling you. I mean, Sean was in the same spot.
True.
You know, these are your orders and it's pretty shitty.
Yeah, I've thought about it a lot and I've been asked this question several times by several people. And the only answer I can come up with, unless you're put in that situation, you don't really, really know what you're going to do. But I could, with almost complete certainty, say that if it was me and I was put in that position, I would probably do what the boss told me to do because he, at the end of the day, he is your boss.
Yeah.
As much as you'd hate to do it, especially if one of the guys is your friend, you know, you'd hate to do it. You know, from a moral standpoint, you feel shitty doing it. But at the end of the day, again, he is your boss. This is your job. Unless you have something else lined up, where are you going to go? You don't listen to the boss. You lose your job. Are you going to go to WCW and make $2.5 million a year? I think not.
And it's also not a situation where Earl Hebner is told this and he can go back and he can sit down and he can weigh the pros and the cons and
right.
Figure out what's – you have literally – he could have had 2 minutes notice. You've got a knee-jerk reaction here of what to do. So
exactly.
I've really never faulted Earl Hebner being in this spot. I think it's a terrible spot where he was pretty much an innocent bystander in this impasse between Brett, Vince, and Sean.
We have such clarity on his side of things right now, on that whole perspective. But think about, you know, the years after that documentary came out, just all the animosity that has been directed towards Earl Hebner. And nobody, I've never really, up until when Brett started talking again in recent years, I've never heard really anybody talk about Earl's side of things from that perspective, that he was really put into this hard position.
Yeah, the one thing I found interesting, though, is because Brett has said it several times that the night before in Detroit, he pulled Earl aside and had a conversation with mm-hmm. him, that he had an inkling that something like this might happen. And I found that very, very interesting because, you know, why would Brett think that? See, that was the first thing that came up. Why would you think something like that? Do you think this scenario that you're talking to Earl about, saying that they're going to try and screw me tomorrow, why is this in your head?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Maybe. And so when I heard him say that, now I started thinking to myself, you know, of course, the worker in me is starting to think, well, was this whole Montreal scenario a huge work by three people, possibly four, Vince, Brett, and Sean, thinking we're going to work everybody and pull off the biggest supposed screw job in the history of the business, and then when Brett's contract is up, he comes back as the big hero? That starts filtering through my mind after hearing this thing. But then, I don't know. See, I'm still kind of leaning towards it's real, but, you know, at times...
You're still not convinced, even now.
Even now, there's elements in the back of my mind that thinking, you know, they started it off as working everybody, and then it turned very real for some reason, and something happened that kind of pissed everybody off. So there's still in the back of my mind, there's still that slight bit of doubt. I'm not saying it's a huge, but there's a little bit of doubt back there.
I can totally see it at the time. Like, I fully believe that this was legit what happened at Montreal. But your wrestling side, it's like, this could have been the booked finish and how everyone comes out great. Vince is the biggest heel in the business. Brett is the biggest babyface going off to WCW. And you've got Sean, who's just as over as a heel for screwing Brett here. And that can translate into a program with Austin, with Owen. I mean, you really, everyone came off with, you had tons of sympathy for this babyface who was, you know, robbed in his hometown.
Yeah.
I mean, if you were, I'm surprised no one even thought of, like, doing this finish.
Right.
Well, but why would the WWE want to give WCW a giant baby face?
Because Bret had leverage at that point to be able to turn down any finish he didn't want to be a part of.
Okay. Mm-hmm. But why would Vince agree to that? I mean, ultimately, he still has say, right?
He does, but he had signed a contract that gave Bret reasonable creative control. And if Bret didn't want to drop it to Shawn that night, that was deemed reasonable. If he said, I'll drop it to anybody else any other night, he had offered to drop it in Detroit. He had offered to drop it in Ottawa. Yeah. He had offered to work the next pay-per-view.
But that meant nothing. It meant nothing in the end.
Well, it didn't, but I mean, he had signed this contract, so it wasn't as if Vince had all the power here. He had given Bret leverage here. Bret had the title, and you had to compromise something, and that would result in Bret having some leverage here. And the way they did it, they gave WCW the biggest star in the business on a platter coming out of Survivor Series.
Yeah,
that's what they chose to do.
I don't think, though, anybody...
WCW fumbled it.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody could have seen this coming. Could have seen any of the following boom in the WWE coming. Could have seen WCW's collapse. I don't think anybody could have predicted that. I think it was just one of those instances that had happened. It was such big news. And certain people knew how to capitalize on it, and certain people didn't. And I think that's what we had. Getting back to the DVD... Shawn, I thought, in this segment was just really compelling to watch because he just expresses so much guilt for what he did. And in fact, he talks about something that I didn't even know about, that he and Bret had a conversation right before they pretty much went out there to have a match backstage, talking about, you know, like Bret was just like, this was after the finish had already been planned in Shawn's mind, and Shawn knew he was going to go ahead with this, feeling really nervous. Meanwhile, like, Bret comes in here and starts talking to him. Hey, I know we've had our differences, but I just want you to know I really, really respect you, and, you know, I really enjoyed working with you and whatnot. And, like, Shawn talking about this in this interview just, like, tears up because, like, imagine the... what was weighing down on this guy. I'm having this heart-to-heart chat with you right before I'm about to stab you in the back, basically.
Yeah, and it's weird. I mean, imagine how we feel. Like, obviously, you know, my earlier statement about having this slight bit of doubt, but, you know, the boss asks you to do something that you know is going to make you probably alienate you from 90% of the locker room now.
Yeah.
And so to be put in that position, you know, like we talked about Earl being put in that position, you know, Shawn obviously was put in a position too. And I just can't imagine having to do something like that. And then, you know, I guess that ate away at Shawn and actually, you know, created more of that antagonistic kind of attitude he developed afterwards.
It was also interesting just how apologetic Shawn was, and you could tell, like, this was not something where, you know, sometimes you'll see guys on camera and it just is, they're very transparent and working the camera. I didn't think that came across here. And Bret just instantly came back and really felt like didn't meet him halfway here, where Bret just says, well, if it was me, I wouldn't have done it. I would never in a million years screw over a fellow worker like Shawn did. And it was just, you know... Bret's the guy who was the victim of this, so I mean, he has every right to say that. But it's just, it's a very complicated issue that you really can't just simply paint black and white.
But more so than that, I felt like Shawn really carries an attitude at this point in his life that he has bigger problems to worry about than what this whole thing was.
I thought there were numerous times in this DVD where he chose not to argue Bret on the point where... someone else maybe would have and could have been more argumentative. And in this case, Shawn was simply showed up with a white flag and threw it on a number of arguments.
Yeah, several times he said it. Well, you know, you remember it that way. That you're probably right, as opposed to, you know, like you said, challenging.
Bret, on the other hand, like really, really, I mean, this is his legacy. This is really his life. So he still. Defends it to the death. Mm-hmm.
And he's very proud stating that, you know, if you go back to any of my interviews and since that time, my story about Montreal has never changed. I've always been consistent with my story, with my reasons, because he's always attached himself to facts. And that's why when someone like Bret Hart speaks or he asks you to believe what he's saying, I think you're more apt to than a Hogan or a Kurt Angle, who have told so many tall tales that they've kind of zapped their credibility when it comes to asking the viewer to believe their side of the story. Bret has always just been factual about what he's put out from mm-hmm. his side. So that was 40 minutes on Montreal, and then they kind of briefly delve into kind of where both guys went after. It was almost like both had this big fall, with Shawn having to retire prematurely just a few months later after the casket match with The Undertaker, mm-hmm. and Bret going through numerous problems, the least of which was how WCW handled him. But then the concussions, the stroke, the death of Owen, the death mm-hmm. of Bulldog, his parents... he went through an unbelievable amount, and it's not until you like list all the things Bret had go on with his life, 2 divorces as well.
Right.
Bret had a rough number of years before making peace with the WWE.
Yeah, and it's one of those things. It was compounded. Everything, it was like one after the other. I mean, and you can't help but feel for him, because you know how much can a guy take. You know, he's bearing this burden of Montreal with him, and for years and years afterwards, he carried that with him. And then you know, the passing of his brother Owen, which really hit him hard. And you know, it, from there, it was just a snowball effect. So,
what limited, if any, interaction did you have with Bret following his departure from the WWE?
Funny, I actually ran into Bret at Carl DeMarco's stag party when he was getting married. Way back when he was at WCW at the time, and we were sitting and we were chatting and we were having a very, very friendly conversation, and I just brought it up. I just said, so how are things going over there in WCW? He says, oh, you're not going to believe it. I said, what? Is it really that bad? Because I said, we hear stories, but we're not there. We don't know. He says, I'll give you an example. He says, we're going into Monday Nitro. It's 8:05 before we go live on the air, and Eric Bischoff is walking by, and I grab him, and I go, Eric, what am I doing tonight? And Eric turns around and says, I haven't got there yet, and walks away. This is 5 minutes before they go live on the air. Wow. And right there, I just thought to myself, man, these guys just don't know what to do with this guy. It's amazing.
I thought he had one, maybe not one great moment, but very few. But the one big one that stands out was right here in Toronto with the angle with Bill Goldberg with the steel plate.
Yeah.
And just Bret recollecting just the problems just to get that angle across, where everyone was in Goldberg's ear about, you can't let this guy kill you like this in his hometown. And just, it was just, this company was just in such disarray by that point. And I think in early 98, it was, WCW was still ahead in the first few months of the year, but it was so evident that this flow was about to change rapidly when you had, it was like everything was clicking in WWF, and it seemed that Tyson coming in was just the last ingredient to bring in a lot of fans who were curious about this freak show attraction in Mike Tyson, and watching a product that they stuck with long after Tyson left, and the flow changed right after WrestleMania that year, and WCW, in my opinion, it never recovered.
No, and from stories that I've heard, again, I was never in WCW, so I don't know. The stories that I heard, it was simply a case of the inmates running the asylum there. I mean, every top guy had creative control. Everybody had say so over their character and what they were doing, so... You know, you can't have that in the WWE. You know, Vince is the boss. What he says goes. It doesn't matter what you think, you know, so.
At the time when Bret was, you know, going through some of his lowest moments, recovering from the stroke, that was also the time when Shawn Michaels made his return for a second run in the WWE. Did you have any idea that he would be sticking around as long as he did in 2002?
No, I don't think anybody did. I think he was coming back for a short period of time, and he was feeling much better, obviously, and he had found peace with himself, which, you know, honestly, I some guys weren't totally buying the whole, you know, attitude change from Shawn Michaels and him finding peace in his beliefs and that sort of thing. But to me, he looked like he genuinely changed from the guy he was before. And again, it didn't look like he was coming in for on a full-time basis. It looked like he was pretty much going to be, coming in for a short-term feud with Hunter, but he felt better, he felt good, and he continued, and, you know, we got great matches out of him for it, too.
That first match with Hunter at SummerSlam was just so incredible because, I mean, just as a fan, you don't know the condition of this guy's back. You're thinking maybe, you know, he'll be extremely protected and, you know, maybe just get a quick match out of there. But then he started taking all these backbreakers on a chair. And you're just like, holy shit, we couldn't believe this. Were you aware of the condition of his injuries?
At that time in 2002, we were watching and everybody was concerned. I mean, obviously, we didn't know really what the condition of his back was. And I guess he felt good. I mean, like he did all that stuff and he came out of it pretty much unscathed. And I think, you know, when he got to the back, he had this grin on his face. It was almost like, you know what? I just proved to myself that my back is okay, at least for now. Mm-hmm. Maybe I can keep going.
And it's just amazing to look back. Had Sean not made that return, I don't know how well remembered he would be. Like, he was a phenomenal talent in the 90s. But I think this return run was as big, if not bigger, than before. I would say bigger. It was, and sure. Look how he's remembered now as this humbler version of Shawn Michaels, who is kind of just completely got rid of that persona he had in the 90s amongst people, and just kind of making amends with a lot of people, such as Brett in this DVD.
Absolutely. Brett himself would have a reconciliation with Vince McMahon in the form of a phone call as he was recovering from his stroke. And I think that eventually led to the formation of the DVD and also the Hall of Fame induction. When the word got out that Brett was dealing with the WWE again, what was the reaction like with everybody?
Everybody was actually pretty happy. I mean, they were hoping that this would come to, you know, around eventually. Nobody thought it would. But when word started to leak out that Vince had called Brett after his stroke, everybody thought that was really, really a real starting point, a launching point for the healing process. Hopefully Brett would be accepting, and he was. So, you know, everybody was pretty much excited that this might lead to a reconciliation. Everybody knew at the time that Brett probably wouldn't be able to compete in the ring, you know, in any real capacity, but they were hoping that at least these two could get together and mend fences, you know.
And it took a long time. It seemed that there were always ideas thrown out about using Brett, and he would always turn it down, even with the Hall of Fame. I mean, he didn't come to WrestleMania that night to do the traditional introducing all the Hall of Fame inductees. He didn't go to the show, and I think it really weighed on him, you know, how adamantly he had been upset with the company that he felt, you know, how would people perceive him now coming back? And I don't think he really got any kind of backlash when he returned in 2010. I think enough people understood his story and realized this guy's not coming back for money. He's, you know, bearing a legitimate burden with the company.
He seemed really concerned about disappointing his fans, in particular the Canadian fans. And Brett starts choking up when he starts talking about this on the DVD, how, you know, through all the things that he said over the years, how you know, I don't know, just everything that had happened between the screw job, between Owen, between everything, he wanted to maintain his word for his fans that he wasn't going to come back. He wasn't going to do this. But when he did, this was seemed to be a huge, huge issue of concern for him. But I don't think he realized that him coming back meant reestablishing that connection with the fans. And I think that's why everybody was so happy, because him coming back meant that the fans would be able to see him more often. And you know, that's good for everybody.
Yeah, and throughout his career, he's been very, very adamant, his career as a babyface, that you know, everything he does is for the good of his fans, and he's always, you know, had high regard for his fans, and you know, you got to admire the guy, because, you know, he really, really wants to provide for them, you know, and whether it's reciprocal, you know, like he enjoys the reaction he gets from the fans, but he really wants to perform for them, and it's been an ongoing theme of his throughout his career.
Yeah, I always got the sense, even talking to him, that he always, I think for a long period, wanted to come back, but just couldn't justify it in his head coming back. And it seemed that it was just suddenly something clicked for him, and he reached out to them. It wasn't the WWE trying once again to get him. It was Brett saying, "Hey, I'm up for doing something if you'd like to."
The exact moment seemed to be Shawn's match with Taker at 2 years ago.
Yep.
And Brett just said he was watching this and he felt so inspired by their performances, and it just made him miss it. Just made him miss it. So he got Tyson to tell Shawn that I think Shawn would tell Tyson Kidd that he was regretful of everything that had happened, and the two kind of eventually called each other up. But Shawn didn't do it for the longest time because he was scared, he said.
Mm-hmm. What a weird introduction that must have been, like Harry and Tyson's like first day meeting Shawn Michaels. Like, hey, we're Brett's guys.
Yeah, I could just see it. Now, hopefully you don't screw us, right, Shawn? I don't know.
There's an opening line when you're coming into the company. No heat at all.
None.
So they eventually lead up to that day in Dayton, Ohio, when on Raw, when the two of them eventually met up, and Shawn talks about how he gave Brett a call and left the voicemail message, and Brett responded with a text, and that was really the first interaction the two of them have had all those years. So
texting.
Texting.
Good thing this feud didn't occur in the 60s.
Yeah, no kidding.
Like a call may not have been made.
And that's when Brett says it was all behind him after that point. Some real, very, very genuine conversation between these two people.
Yeah, and it was something I think that was long overdue and needed to be done. I mean, you know, it seems like Brett at the time was carrying that grudge for so long that it needed to be resolved. And it was a genuine feel-good moment, even watching it on television when – watching Shawn and Brett in the ring live that night on Raw.
It was so surreal.
I know.
Just to watch, it was like, that's the last time I can remember watching a wrestling show where, as I was sitting there, it's like, I can't believe I'm seeing this.
Yeah.
And, for people that know the backstory, I mean, mm-hmm. it was amazing that these two were here in a ring together, and it was just fascinating to watch.
Yeah, and as someone who had been there for much of it, seeing these two in the ring, I almost found myself getting a little emotional myself seeing these guys, you know, shake hands and embrace and say, you know what, let's put it behind us, we're done.
And again, like, this whole relationship has been taking place in front of a camera, and this was no different. That day in Dayton was no different. Their first meeting with each other was inside that ring, just like all their problems had taken place before, where it was inside that ring for all of us to see. So this has been about a public rivalry as you could get, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a fascinating DVD. I think perhaps the best DVD the WWE has ever put out. So I highly recommend it. We are going to say goodbye to Mr. Corderas here, as me and Wei will be back with your feedback. I was just skimming through here, and we had opened it up for questions for Jimmy, but we asked you every single question that people had asked. So
oh, really?
We kind of covered everything there. But before we go, Jimmy, tell us where everyone can catch yourself and Arda doing Aftermath.
Yeah, Aftermath, Monday nights after Raw, roughly around 11:20 p.m., you can catch it at radio.thescore.com/live. We are live. We're also, you can get the podcasts at the Score website, and we're on iTunes. And Friday night, you can catch me on Aftermath TV on the Score.
Tell Radio, me. Television, he conquers it all. Jimmy Corderas, and an avid tweeter himself, at Jimmy Corderas. Always fun for his wrestling comments and Occupy Wall Street comments.
Well, no, it's not Wall Street. I'm not occupying Wall Street. I'm not occupying Toronto.
You're occupying everything else.
I occupy my bed. I occupy my bathroom. I occupy my car. And last night, I pretty much occupied a theater.
For 3 hours of vengeance.
Yes. Yes.
So lots of
occupying.
So catch Jimmy and Arda with Aftermath right after Raw, Monday nights, just after 11 p.m. Radio.
Forgot one other thing. Actually, the new thing we've been doing for the last several weeks is the Ask the Ref podcast.
Yes, on Fridays.
On Fridays, which is available at thescore.com also.
So if you want to ask Jimmy a question, Send in your questions, and you have a whole podcast to pick the brain of Jimmy Corderas, WWE veteran. So thanks as always, Jimmy. It's great chatting with you and getting to go back and find out. Always learn new things when we get to chat with you. So thanks as always for joining
us. Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right, checks in the mail.
Yeah.
I mean, I won't look back on my career, as I'm sure Brett doesn't, with any regrets and things like that. But at the same time, you think about, oh, my goodness, what could have been had you at least had your head even remotely screwed on straight, you know? And so, I mean, it was very important to me for us to be able to have that moment. Him and say that I was right, anyway, and more importantly than anything, for him to believe me, more than anything. I mean, I've waited.
You really needed that.
For whatever reason.
Really needed.
For
that.
Whatever reason, I've wanted Bret Hart, whatever, to like me.
Okay, so thanks once again to Jimmy Corderas, who was gracious enough to catch up with us here in the Review Away studios. Mm-hmm. And now we're going to get into everyone's feedback. And I know we did open it up to some questions with Jimmy, but as I said, as I skimmed through these, we pretty much covered everything you wanted to ask in that 1 hour chat with Mr. Cordera. So let's see what everyone else had to say about this DVD. And we start off with Adam Cipelli. There's been so much coverage of this incident that it kind of dragged hearing it all over again. However, hearing it from the men themselves helped make more sense of the whole situation. It did seem like Michaels was genuine about the things he was saying and was a little sad seeing the outcomes of each other's careers in comparison. Overall, a DVD well worth your time and money. Can I please get a big shout out to the All Blacks who just brought home our Rugby World Cup for the first time in 24 years? Signed, New Zealand's biggest Review Away fan. Adam Cipelli, well, congratulations for the rugby players.
The All Blacks.
Which here in our country sounds a bit offensive, but that's an actual name.
I guess so.
I don't know rugby, so.
Is there an All Whites? All Asians?
Yes, and then if they all, I don't know.
Okay. Trey Davis. By far my favorite rivalry ever in wrestling. I started watching wrestling around 92 when Bret won the IC belt from Mr. Perfect and have been a fan of his ever since. I can still remember Hart dropping the title to Michaels in the Iron Man match at WrestleMania 14. I think he means 12. My stepbrother, who was also a Bret mark, told me before Mania that Shawn would win it, but at the time it was so hard to believe Michaels as the WWF champion. After the Iron Man match, Bret disappeared for months, so me and my stepbrother had to watch Michaels mow over everyone. Bret finally came back only to get screwed out of a rematch with Michaels because his smile was missing. Michaels regained his smile later that year when he stole Hart's heel. Okay, I don't know. I may sound like a mark, but even as a kid, I had a feeling Michaels was a dick in real life. In 97, the internet was taking off, and everything was revealed at Montreal. This is the best kayfabe feud ever, and also the best shoot feud in wrestling ever.
Very interesting there. We go to David Banks. Ollie and Frazier, Yankees and Red Sox, L.A. and Boston, and Sean and Bret. You can't say one name without saying the other. Their historic past will forever be linked to one another. We've been treated to some of the best wrestling matches ever by these two men, with WrestleMania 12 being the highlight and the blueprint of how a story inside the ring should be told. This DVD lets us, the fans, go through the black curtain and lets us see and hear how this feud took shape and produced the event in 97 that would change the wrestling world as we know it today. Unlike other WWE-produced DVDs, this is as real and candid as it gets. Shawn and Bret are like apples and oranges, but in the ring together, they were artists, and they painted some of the greatest portraits that we've ever or will ever see.
So they were artists, they were mammals that were evolved from dinosaurs.
They took on all different shapes and sizes.
Okay, let's go to Chad Rivera. I saw this production through some illegal mean earlier this week, but I fully intend on buying this when it comes out. Anyhow, I thought this DVD was very well put together from a production standpoint. Having Jim Ross conduct the interview was awesome. I could see no other person conducting the interview with as much seriousness and credibility as Ross. My only complaint was this is that it seemed that Michaels held back or wasn't as honest on some of the answers as he should or could have been. I'm guessing that is mostly due to his religious beliefs. Again, great piece, and I will enjoy adding this to my WWE library.
I felt Sean. I never got the sense Sean was being dishonest.
I didn't either.
Again, I thought there were at times where Sean simply conceded to Brett on certain points, and I think some of that would be very genuine, that I think he felt he really did wrong this individual, and simply arguing over he said, how conducive is that really?
Mm-hmm.
So, Mike Still, great DVD. I like the idea of WWE doing more of these rivalries, but they won't ever find a feud as complex and actually personal as this one. They did try for an unscripted interview style with Michaels last DVD too, but they must have realized that Jim Ross on top of his game makes it work, and a grinning jackass Michael Cole does not. Michaels and Hart are a very strange contrast today. Feels like both of them have moved on, but there's some deep-rooted feelings in Brett that don't seem to have been laid to rest. Both are guys who take their reputation and their legacies very seriously, but in different ways. Although much more honest and upfront than in his RF shoot, Michaels was still holding back and reluctant to get into touchy areas like his drug use and prick behavior. There were times when it felt like Brett and Sean were called into the principal's office. Mm-hmm. All in all, a great DVD that manages to be as important a new chapter in the story as old ones it recaps. I've heard that a lot of it was cut out too, and Sean did go into a lot about his drug use and stuff, and they made the decision to cut that stuff out. So I don't think that should necessarily be a negative towards Sean.
It totally did feel like they were in the principal's office and just kind of defending themselves. And
imagine two students who could cut promos like this on one another.
Yeah, these weren't really promos. These are just
not promos, but talking. I mean, just getting this delivery 2 hours.
Sure, sure. All right. Let's go to Alexander Rios. I, for one, cannot wait to buy this DVD. It might be the most must-see of the last 5 years. Definitely the must-see of 2011, that's for sure. To me, the rivalry of Brett versus Shawn was probably the main factor that got me back into wrestling in 96-97. Not only was the whole product in an upward climb in momentum, but with those two, you just knew it was more than just the work. The jabs they were taking at each other on Raw in 97 was proof of that. And the whole Montreal screw job, ironically, was never an issue between Sean and Brett. It was an issue between Vince and Brett, with Sean being dragged in the middle because of the storyline direction, which, personally, I always believe the whole screw job fiasco, contrary to the infamous Brett screwed Brett line, Vince really did screw him. Brett's conduct didn't truly expire until... contract didn't truly expire until weeks after Survivor Series, so there was still some time to get the WWF title off of him and let Brett truly leave to WCW with his head held together. Brett was not Medusa. I always believed he had the character to do business, but wasn't given the chance. And even Eric Bischoff himself said he was looking forward to working with Brett with a clean slate. Anyway, this is an awesome choice to review.
Let's go to Joey Howell. This is now my favorite WWE DVD by far. I worshipped Brett as a kid living in Calgary during the 90s. I love that good old JR was the one asking the questions. Good to see that he still has a role in the company besides getting humiliated every Monday on Raw. After watching this DVD, all I can think is I'm surprised Brett never just beat the living shit out of Shawn. Well, they did get into a fight backstage in Hartford where Brett definitely got the better of Shawn.
Daily Brennan, this is an incredible DVD. I have nothing but praise for it. The one thing I often don't like about WWE DVDs is the way that they often skirt around kayfabe. In this DVD, no punches were pulled, and I loved it. My only criticism, it just wasn't long enough.
It was a pretty good length, though. 2 hours of...
Yeah, 2 hours. I agree, though. I think they could have gone even longer, and I would have still been captivated.
Do you think this is going to be a DVD that's going to be a really big seller for the company, especially going into Christmas, or do you feel that this is going to be targeted for a more, older wrestling fan?
But we saw with the ECW DVDs that type of fan will...
That was also years and years ago. I mean, the DVD market has drastically changed.
So then the question
is... Look at how many people we've heard just from here who have watched it online.
The question is whether or not piracy will be harming this DVD. And I don't know. I can't really say. I think a lot of wrestling fans, though, a lot of them are collectors and they want to collect this. And they want to have this on the shelf. I mean, I would go purchase this. Just to have.
Plus, you have a ton of extras on here with all their matches. The Blu-ray actually has a cool feature where they let the camera roll between takes and stuff like that. Not cool. Takes, but just as they were taking breaks and just hearing the two talk together on set. Mm-hmm. I think that would be really interesting. Let's go onwards to Daniel Barrett. I love this DVD, but that said, I don't think it was the greatest the WWE has put out. For me, that title belongs to the Monday Night Wars, with the ECW History DVD a close second. For me, this could have been greatly improved if Vince would have sat in there with Shawn and Bret. So much of the story not only lies with Bret and Shawn, but with Vince too. Ultimately, it was his decision to screw Bret, so what were his thoughts going into the event? It would have been good to see him look Bret in the eyes and explain what he did and why. Anyway, apart from that, I thought it was a brilliant DVD and really told the story well. I rank this ahead, especially of the Monday Night Wars, where there was a lot of factual misinformation, and it was very much telling it from the WWE's point of view, with a lot of just facts that were skewed for the WWE. ECW was more of a clean story, but still had its issues. But that's an excellent DVD, the ECW one.
I feel like a lot of that is aided by the fact that this was just a conversation. There was editing involved, of course, but not to the extent of a bunch of sit down interviews being put together. The editor has a lot less say in what the message is towards the end. Let's go to Dave Maverick Mitchell. SummerSlam 08. Shawn Michaels refuses a photo with me after taking photos with others. January 09. I read Bret's book and become his biggest fan and absolutely hate Shawn Michaels. I tolerated Shawn before, but the book told me that he was a prick, and after the non-photo incident, I really dislike this guy. After watching the Blu-ray, UK and Ireland got it before USA for a change, I could see Michaels as a changed man, and I truly feel sorry, and is truly sorry for his behavior, though he had found God when he refused a photo with me. Anyway, if Bret forgives him, so do I. If you could ask Jimmy how... Yeah, so Jimmy's not here.
I'm not going to crucify a man for not stopping to take a photo. I mean, let's be realistic here about...
Does that say that in the Bible? You must take photos with all...
Must stop for a photo op. All right, we continue onwards here with Corey Ferreira. I saw the documentary, and I can say it was awesome. WWE did a great job with this set. The interview done with Bret and Shawn is an amazing watch, and it goes to show when the WWE lets wrestlers go at it on DVDs, they can truly be great. This is a perfect example of that. The intro packages into the different periods of each man's career is great, showing where both Bret and Shawn were at that point in time. I hope WWE does future rivalry sets in this fashion, because this set was a great start.
You know, you really have to think about it. Could you see, are there any other existing rivalries that are out there right now could have as much heat as this one?
I was talking to Jimmy about this before we were rolling, and he brought up a great point that it's like you're never going to be able to find two guys with this kind of a feud that is relevant to this generation.
Mm-hmm.
You do have the opportunity, like obviously you can do Austin and Rock, but that's going to be completely different than this sort of one. You could do Vince and some people, but it would have to be the right person. Maybe Vince and Jim Ross. That's the thing though. It's like a lot of the ones you want to hear from are like Hogan, Flair, Bischoff, Heyman, ones that are no longer associated with the company.
Not yet.
No, not right now. I would find it really interesting to do maybe a Heyman and Vince. But again, it's like you're talking about a very small audience, I think, for something like that.
Well, as we mentioned, though, but look at the number of people that bought that ECW DVD.
Yeah, that's true. I don't know. I think it could definitely be done if The Undertaker wanted to do some out of character. Which, again, there's a lot of there's some limitations.
Let's go to Andrew Sheehy. There was no rivalry in the world of pro wrestling that spread into real life like the rivalry between Shawn and Bret. They were two great workers who helped carry the WWE during a down period in the 1990s. Their matches at the 92 Survivor Series and WrestleMania 12 stand out. They also competed in the first ladder match in WWE history at a TV taping in 92 for Coliseum Video. This DVD is a must-see for wrestling fans out there. I want you guys to review the 91 Survivor Series because it's the 20th anniversary of The Undertaker's first WWE title victory.
All right, and that's going to bring us to a close. And what's going to be happening next week? First of all, thanks to everyone for your feedback, which you can always leave at reviewaway.com. That's reviewaway.com. And over at liveaudiowrestling.com, I am furiously trying to resurrect our archives. Mm-hmm. And this has been a very big project. I have now got rid of all the crap, so it looks nice. It looks proper, and now I'm figuring out the dead links issue, which is taking me more time now because I'm separating the law from review away. So it means getting the other file, then rendering two other files, and then uploading. Yeah. And I've got like a lot of years to cover.
There has to be an easier way. It really does.
You would think so, but
all right.
I don't foresee one.
Well, good luck.
I will need it. But it's coming along, folks. I'm working backwards. So I think you can listen to every review a Raw and review an Impact from April of this year onwards, and you can hear every Law and review away going back to November of 2010. So okay. I'm going backwards. I'm going to get it all done.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's getting there. But next week, Way, we are going to be chatting Saturday night's main event from 1985, and it was a special Halloween edition of Saturday Night's Main Event, because next week is Halloween, and what better way to celebrate Halloween than by listening to Me and Way 2 days after Halloween?
There's no better way.
So Me and Way are going to dress up for the podcast next week. I hope you guys do as well when you listen and download, and we'll be chatting Saturday Night's Main Event. I have no idea what's on this show.
Me neither. I mean, you and I were both one and a half when this came out.
This was way back in the day.
So I would not have seen this before.
So that's going to wrap us up for today. We're going to be back on Friday with Review and Impact, chatting with Nate Milton, as always, about whatever's going on in the world of TNA. It's always fascinating. And then this Sunday, it's The Law, midnight Eastern on TSN Radio, 10:50 a.m. Mr. Ting, as we sign off here, what tune would you like to end things with?
Well, I think there is only one choice I can choose for a DVD and a topic like this. Hopefully we can finally put to rest any discussion about Montreal Survivor Series. It's over. It's done. There's nothing else that needs to be said. So perhaps it is time to say goodbye. And
I'm so glad you chose this.
I don't know. Here's a song from
Here's Bret Hart saying goodbye as we say goodbye. And once again, a big thank you to Jimmy Corderas, who sat in with us. And you can catch him with Art O'Cal Monday nights Aftermath at radio.thescore.com. We're out. Say goodbye, Brett.
Say goodbye. never been a right time.